Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Thomas Carey, who is the co-author of Inside the Real Area 51, The Secret History of Wright-Patterson. Thomas Carey holds a master's degree in anthropology and is an Air Force veteran who held a top secret security clearance. And he has spent the last 22 years investigating the Roswell incident. And with his co-author, Donald Schmidt, has written this book, a very interesting book with some very good evidence and compilation work about the role of the military in the investigation of potential extraterrestrial activity. Thanks, Thomas, for joining us.
Dr. Kolb, it's a pleasure to be with you.
So where are you calling in from?
I am currently, I'm calling in from just outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, a little township, Huntington Valley, Pennsylvania.
Great. Well, would you like to tell our listeners how you got interested in the UFO stories, and particularly how you got interested in the role of the military, especially the Air Force, in investigating them?
Yes, I became interested in UFOs when I was just a little kid, about 8 years old. My older brother, who's now a professor emeritus at a major university on the East Coast, he's 3 years older than I am, and while I was out, playing in the neighborhood, rough house, you know, as any eight-year-old boy would do. My brother, who, they used to give you IQ tests, and he always tested out his genius. You know, there was no getting around it. He read things like newspapers, even at that age. And I came in one day, and he said, "Hey, Tom, listen to this." And he read me a story from the Philadelphia Evening Bulletin, which is now no longer in print. He said, "Listen to this. It's about these things called flying discs that can outrun our fastest fighter planes." And I couldn't imagine that because I was a military. I knew all the fighter planes and things like that. And I couldn't imagine what these fiery flying discs were. So that got my interest piqued, and it ebbed and flowed over the ensuing years. And as a teenager, I started reading a few books by Donald Kehoe and the former head of Project Blue Book, Edward Ruppelt, and it kept my interest alive. But I that was pretty much it. I just read a couple books, but I was always interested. Then, in 1980, a book came out called The Roswell Incident by Charles Berlitz and William Moore, and I read that book. It was about a crashed UFO, not just lights in the sky, flitting around. This was about a UFO that had allegedly crashed in New Mexico with a flight crew, and that book just blew me away because we were talking about nuts and bolts craft, a machine of some sort that had crashed with dead occupants. And once I read that book, I said, "Oh my goodness, this is really something." And I lost interest in most other UFO reports because they were just reports with no tangible evidence apparent. So by this time, I had gone to graduate school, had an advanced degree in anthropology and had attended graduate school for a doctorate, but I didn't get that far. So when I came back home, I wanted to do something in the UFO field that was of an investigative nature, not just reading about them. So I joined MUFON and QFOS, the Center for UFO Studies in Chicago, and on the staff of QFOS at the time were these two investigators, Donald Schmidt and Kevin Randall, who at the time were reopening the Roswell case. Now, the original book came out in 1980, but nothing further had been done on the case of a public nature, except a few update articles by William Moore. But you had to be like in the, you know, on the inside the Beltway type thing, either in MUFON or QFOS to know, even know about those articles. Mm-hmm. So I called up Kevin, and I asked him, because I had a background in anthropology and archaeology, I said, what have you done about trying to locate the archaeologist who apparently had stumbled upon the downed craft and the bodies? And he said, well, we had a name or two that we checked out, and those fellows were already dead, and there was no apparent connection to Roswell because they hadn't been in the field in 1947 in New Mexico. So I said, look, the story is that these archaeologists were from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. And I said, I'm living right outside of Philadelphia, got a background in that subject. Let me have a crack at it. I'll go down to the university and nose around and see what I can find out. So that's how I got started in the actual investigation of the case. I went down to the university and the archives of the University of Pennsylvania, the anthropology department, and came up with a name or two. And I can tell you, Dr. Kolb, that I interviewed every living archaeologist at the time. This would be 1991 now. Mm-hmm. Everyone that was still alive in archaeology that was in the field in New Mexico in 1947, I interviewed every one of them, a few in person, mostly by phone, and I wrote up my findings, and that's how I got active in the investigation of the Roswell case. And I've really not done any other case since 1991 other than the Roswell case.
Well, let me ask you something about the Roswell incident that was interesting to me. I had read in, it might have been in Stan Friedman's book or one of the other books on the interviews I've done, that we accidentally were, at first accidentally were creating conditions that would cause the crashes of these disks. Have you heard anything about that, that it had something to do with either radar or something like that?
I've heard this radar story now a number of times, and I just mm-hmm. don't ascribe anything to it. There was radar, you know, was developed by the British, and our radar systems were developed during World War II, and they were still not really well developed by 1947, although we did have it. But I don't know where these stories about the radar have just come out of thin air, as far as I'm concerned. A more likely scenario as to why this craft crashed, mm-hmm. at least in my opinion, there are two possible scenarios. One, an internal explosion of some sort. Mm-hmm. You know, of which we don't know what caused it. Maybe somebody pressed the wrong button. You don't know. An internal explosion, or July is the so-called monsoon season in New Mexico in the Southwest, where you have these mm-hmm. tremendous lightning and thunderstorms, oftentimes without even rain developing. I've been down there at that time. I've never seen lightning like this. And mm-hmm. We have a number of eyewitnesses or ear witnesses who were awake at the time, late at night on mm-hmm. On July the 2nd, 1947, near midnight, and they hear the thunderclaps, and they heard a muffled explosion between thunderclaps that didn't sound like the other rest of the thunder,
mm-hmm.
and we presume that was the ship exploding. So and we really don't know for sure, but the speculation is that it was struck by lightning, one of these terrific thunderbolts of lightning that struck the ship and it exploded at that point. So to me, those are the two most likely scenarios, either a lightning strike or an an internal explosion of some sort. The radar thing, I just don't buy that.
And then, is there evidence that there might have been two ships that crashed at Roswell?
No, there's no evidence
just
that
one?
There were just one.
Okay.
The two ship theory came about because when they wrote the 1980 book, The Roswell Incident, the only story at that time that had bodies, little bodies attached to it, alien bodies, was this story from a conservation engineer living in Socorro who claimed to have come across a downed flying saucer with the dead crew strewn about. The fellow's name was Barney Barnett. That was the only story that had alien bodies attached to it. So they just penciled in, well, there must have been two ships, the one that crashed near Roswell and then the one that crashed on the plains of San Augustine near Socorro that had the bodies. So we have investigated that ad infinitum, and there is no evidence for a UFO crash on the plains of San Augustine in 1947. Mm-hmm. Even Stan Friedman has now, at least, you know, I know him and talking to him, he has accepted that conclusion that if indeed this UFO case that Barney Barnett was talking about occurred, it wasn't in 1947 and had nothing to do with the Roswell crash.
So the Roswell crash, just for our listeners who may not know about it, do you want to describe what is known about it, including the metal, the malleable metal that was found in the fields?
Yes, the short of it is because we do have over 600 first and secondhand witnesses to an extraterrestrial event. None of them are talking about a weather balloon, but...
All right.
Basically, what happened was on the night of July the 2nd, 1947, a UFO was crashed 45 miles northwest of, let me backtrack. It didn't crash 45 miles northwest of Roswell. It exploded in midair, either by a lightning strike or internal, and spewed down all of these pieces of small wreckage on a small sheep pasture near the town of Corona.
Okay.
Now, it is, and so that is known as the debris field site. It's where the thing explodes and rains down all this debris. Now, our investigation has concluded that the inner cabin of the ship, or an escape capsule of some sort, that withstood the explosion, continued on for another 30 miles.
Right.
But just 2 miles east of that debris field site that I just described for you, two of the occupants of the ship that apparently were not inside the inner cabin or the capsule were thrown out and came to rest on a small bluff just 2.5 miles east of the debris field site. We call that the Twin Mills site, or the Deep Proctor site, after the gentleman who showed it to us. And actually, I stood on that bluff 1 week ago. We were down there doing an archaeological dig, but I made a point to get over there and actually climbed up and stood on that bluff and had some pictures taken. So you have the debris field site, the site where a low bluff where two beings had come to rest were eventually discovered by Mac Brazel, the rancher, the sheep rancher. Then continuing on for another 30 miles is the inner cabin, let's call it, which came to rest about 30 miles due north of Roswell and about 5 miles due west of Highway 285. And that was the inner cabin. That's where additional bodies were found, perhaps three more, and most importantly, one was still alive. A fourth being was still alive, and all of this was discovered by a group of archaeologists out doing a site survey the morning of July the 7th. And the military goes out there. They shoo everybody away. threaten people with their lives. They say, don't ever, ever talk about this. We're going to kill everybody. And this is the truth.
Yeah.
And so they recovered the material and the bodies from the three sites, returned them to the air base south of Roswell, Roswell Army Airfield. And from there, they ultimately were deposited at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Back in 1947, it was either Wright Field or Patterson Field in Dayton, Ohio. And that's where the material and the bodies were kept for the next 35 years, after which they went elsewhere. The cover-up is still in place. And the military will never, I repeat this, they will never come clean on Roswell. They will never come clean on UFOs because they have too much splaining to do. And that's it in a nutshell.
Well, let's talk a little bit about why Wright-Patterson would be the place that they would have been sent logically, what that base was about and what its mission was.
Yes. Wright-Patterson was an airfield, started out as an airfield developed by the Wright brothers, who invented that flying contraption known as an airplane.
The airplane.
Yes, and they started an air, and they, you know, founded an airstrip just north of Dayton, Ohio, to continue the development of their flying machine. Well, that was in 1903. Well, along comes World War One, 1917, for the United States. So the military takes over the airstrip, and it becomes an air base. Now, I'm not going to go through all the various iterations of what they called Wright-Patterson, but there's a lot of them, and you can get a headache just trying to keep track of them. So I'll just always refer to it as Wright-Patterson. Well, World War One comes along, and it becomes a major base for our Air Corps. And what really gave it the jump start to make it our most important Air Force base was World War II, when they expand all of the functions and it becomes not only the brains of the Air Force with its intelligence function and its development of aircraft function. All of the aircraft, new aircraft, were developed there. It also became the heart of the Air Force with its supply and logistics functions. So you have all of these functions headquartered at Wright-Patterson during World War II, and it's just the most important base in our inventory. Well, one of the most important functions was the so-called back engineering or re-engineering of enemy aircraft. Like during World War II, was Japanese and German. They would they would bring Messerschmitts and Mitsubishis to Wright-Patterson to tear them apart, to see what made them tick, put them back together again, and fly them, and develop aircraft or capabilities to defeat them in battle. And that was they already had this engineering, this back engineering function going in World War II. They also had advanced biological medical facilities at the base. The latest and the greatest were also housed at the base, the Aeromedical Squadron. So when and they developed, all of this was under the, except the biomedical, was under the FTD, or the Foreign Technology Division. One part of it was intelligence, the other part of it was engineering. So when the crash occurred in 47 of this extremely foreign technology from another planet, Wright-Patterson was the logical destination for this material, the wreckage and the bodies, because they already had capabilities more so than any other base in our military to conduct studies of the wreckage and the alien life forms. So that's why they went to Wright-Patterson and not to any other base, because they already were in that business. They were used to, and during the Cold War, instead of Messerschmitts and Mitsubishis, they were MiGs. Russian MiGs would be brought there for the same purpose, tear them apart, see what made them tick, develop what were their advantages and disadvantages, and try to develop capabilities to defeat them. So that's why all the Roswell wreckage went to Wright-Patterson.
Well, as I told you before the interview, I spent 4 years at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base as the chief of plastic surgery, and it was from 84 to 88. And during that time, several high-ranking officers, I remember one general and some other high-ranking officers, independently told me that they had seen live aliens. So I guess my next question is, could it have been that wreckages from not just Roswell, but other wreckages were also brought to Wright-Patt?
That's what it sounds like, Doctor. The one live alien from Roswell, we have heard several stories.
Mm-hmm.
One that it was taken to Wright-Patterson, which is the logical place. And it lived an additional 5 years, which would make it 1952 when it expired.
Mm-hmm.
We heard another story where it lived for 15 years, which would make it 1962, I guess, if my math is right, until it expired. So if you were there during
84 to 88, but, you know, the people that I was taking care of were older. They were not... You know, they were not in their 20s and 30s. They were 50s, 60s, yeah.
So they didn't give you a time frame as to when?
No. No, but I'll tell you, Stan Friedman, who I interviewed, said that he was doing a book signing in Dayton, and seven different people in line told him that they had seen live aliens. So, I mean, you know, it's kind of interesting that that on the sly they may mention to other people, well, you know, it'd be hard to, even under the threat of military action against you, I think that in more safe circumstances with your doctor or maybe with a UFO expert, you might mention that you'd seen them.
Well, because if they were talking in the plural, like they said they saw live aliens, plural, then it would have to be other UFO crashes, because the Roswell crash only had one.
Yeah.
We've had a number of people who were either out in the field, in the hospital, and they all described just one. So if the Stan sources said they saw aliens in plural, it would have to be other crashes.
Yeah. Well, it would make sense that other crashes occur. I mean, there was a crash, I believe, in Texas before airplanes were even invented. So,
oh, is that the Aurora?
Yeah, yeah. So we know there's other crashes. You know, there are definitely crashes.
There are other described crashes, the Aurora being one, and that's a very interesting case because they allegedly buried the occupant in a gray, you know, in a gray, unmarked
grave.
Right,
yeah.
And it seems to have disappeared.
Yeah, well, I imagine the military would have dug it up pretty quickly once they learned that it probably was real.
Right.
They would,
And then the 1941 Cape Girardeau case in Missouri is another alleged pre-Roswell crash. So, I wouldn't say there's no, you know, I wouldn't say definitively that Roswell was the first one, but it certainly is the, for evidence sake, it certainly is the most thoroughly investigated UFO case of all time, and it presents the most evidence in the form of testimony, suggestive documents, and some other things that we are working on as we speak. So.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the material that was found and some of the qualities of the material and some of the back engineering attempts on the material. And then we'll talk a little bit later about what the actual bodies and the live alien information was, because you have quite a bit of that in your book as well.
Yes. I was never one. I've heard the stories of things like Velcro and, you know, almost anything was traceable back to Roswell. You know, but I never put much stock in it. Because I'm thinking, like, you know, transistors was another one. Oh, you know, that comes from Roswell, and integrated circuit boards and stuff like that. Well, my mind has done a 180 on at least certain things, fiber optics being one, little something akin to fiber optics is one of the pieces of wreckage that was described, you know, wires that that carry you know, electronic impulses, and we use them today for many things, and there were things at the Roswell crash that sound like fiber optics. Now,
right,
the most bizarre piece of wreckage, and there was a lot of it. This is what's amazing. There was a lot of it, or is what we call memory metal, pieces of what appear to be metal that you could take and wad up in your hand, like, you know, like a piece of tissue paper. You wouldn't feel anything in your hand, but you would open your hand over a flat surface, and before it hit the surface, it would flatten right out in its original shape without a crease. Not only that, you couldn't scratch it, you couldn't dent it, you couldn't cut it, you couldn't burn it, you couldn't deform it in any way that it would remain deformed. It would always go back to its original shape. And that's what that is our holy grail of Roswell. We hope to find a piece of that, because, you know, there have been a number of little pieces of metal that people have claimed came from Roswell. And they go off and they're tested, and you never hear about them again. They sort of disappear, even though the owners will say, oh, yes, this is definitely, you know, some of the isotopic characteristics say that they're not from this planet. Well, let's have some independent people do the same studies and see what they come up with. But you never hear about that anymore. They sort of fade away. So that's why we talk about the memory metal being our holy grail, because you can just look at that and put it through its paces, and you can stand there and say, oh, my goodness, we don't have anything like that yet. However, with a big however, a fellow in Florida, one of our associates named Anthony Bergaglia, took it upon himself to try to determine what happened to the wreckage that went to Wright-Patterson. And in one of the witness interviews that we did with General Arthur Exon, who was the former base commander at Wright-Patterson during the 1960s, he said that although he never had access to the actual material or the bodies, he had friends on the base, you know, being the base commander, he had friends who had. And he said the consensus was that the pieces of wreckage were, quote, from space, unquote. The pieces of wreckage were from space. That was the conclusion of the analyst. Well, he also said that in studying the wreckage, the main ingredient, the main element of the wreckage was titanium and some other alloy which he didn't know the name of. So Anthony Bergaglia started searching for, he would plug self-healing metal, morphing metal, and something, you know, memory metal into his web browser, and he came up with a number of studies that were done by scientists from New York University and other places, combining titanium with other elements to try to develop self-healing metal or shape-shifting metal. And so he actually got a couple of those studies online, printed them out, and he read them, and I've read them too, and it, believe me, it gives you a headache to read these metallurgical studies. It's just, oh my goodness, this stuff is just too heavy going. And what Anthony noticed was, in a number of these, in the footnotes, there was a reference to studies conducted by Battelle Memorial Institute in Columbus, Ohio, in the late 1940s, who had credited, under a contract issued to them by Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, the Foreign Technology Division. Smoking gun. And so these reports referenced, or these studies referenced, progress reports from Battelle to Wright-Patterson. Mm-hmm. And Bregaglia tried to get a hold of those progress reports because the proximity of these reports to the Roswell crash, these reports began in 1948, just right after the Roswell stuff was delivered there. And he found out that these were, in fact, attempts to replicate the memory metal from Roswell.
Right. Yeah.
And the end result, it was the development of something we call nitinol. It's spelled N-I-T-I-N-O-L. N-I for nickel, T-I for titanium, and the N-O-L was for the Naval Ordnance Lab, who was also privy to the Battelle studies. Nitinol was developed by the Naval Ordnance Lab, or at least announced, in 1962. So you can plug nitinol into your browser and see what comes up. It's our best attempt, in short here, it's our best attempt at trying to replicate the Roswell memory metal. That's exactly what it is. You can buy it today. You can buy it by the sheet. You can buy it by the roll and buy it by the coil for industrial use. So I believe Anthony has proved, at least for me, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that that's where that particular new product, nitinol, originated, was from the Roswell crash.
So how close do you think they came to replicating it?
Well, it's self-healing. It's shape-shifting. It's memory metal. It'll go back to its original state. But you, unlike the Roswell memory metal, it is not indestructible. See, that's the difference. The memory metal from Roswell is indestructible. The stuff that we've been able to create from it is not indestructible, but it is used in things from, like, your if you have eyeglasses where your eye frames, you can twist them around, and that mm-hmm. Well, that's from nitinol, and it's also now used in our space program by coincidence. So there are plenty of uses for it, and the main feature of it is its shape recovery. And this was unknown prior to Roswell, and there were no studies. Anthony was also able to determine in a search of the literature, there were no studies of this titanium combination with other metals prior to the Roswell event.
Well, are there any other evidence of labs or universities working on other types of technologies right after that incident?
Well, we know that New York University had contracts also. You know, you had Battelle Memorial Institute, and you had the New York University also working on it. Now, New York University was also part of this Mogul balloon project that the Air Force says resulted in the Roswell crash, where, you know, they had these balloons, rubber balloons and tinfoil radar targets lifting these acoustic sensors high into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Into the stratosphere to try to listen in on the expected detonation of an atomic device by the Soviet Union in the late 40s. Mm-hmm. New York University was the university of choice to participate in this. So we know they were involved in the Nitinol. Now, as far as other items, as I said, perhaps fiber optics comes the closest to something that can be traced to the Roswell wreckage.
Now, was that because there was a contract with early fiber optic research with Wright Field, or is that just because there were fiber optics materials found in the wreckage?
It's the latter, because okay. fiber optic type wreckage material, wire type things mm-hmm. were found in the wreckage, and lo and behold, now we have fiber optics. And
yeah.
We have done, perhaps somebody has researched that. We have not researched the fiber optics, but the similarity between the two is startling.
Mm-hmm. Do you know when fiber optics were researched initially? What time frame?
I do not know.
That'd be interesting.
I do not know. Like we know the memory metal, we know the history of the memory metal development. But the fiber optics, no, that's something that could be researched. But mm-hmm. we feel that the similarity between the two, between our development of fiber optics after Roswell and the presence of fiber optic type material at the crash site is pretty stark.
Now, one of the reports stated, or one of the eyewitnesses stated, that the craft had no engine.
Yes.
You'd like to comment on that? That's
yes.
pretty interesting.
That's an interesting story that's only developed recently. There's a witness. He lived in Roswell. His name is William Ennis. He's in the base yearbook. The base had a yearbook with everybody's picture in it for 1947. And William Ennis was a sergeant in the 603rd, 315th Bomber Squadron. And, as you interview people, they say, oh, you ought to talk to this fellow or you ought to talk to that fellow. And William Ennis was one of the names that was given to us, and we checked it out. Yes, he's in the yearbook, and he lived in Roswell. So we went to William Ennis. This is about 10 years ago, and he denied any knowledge of being involved. Mm-hmm. Yes, he heard about it, but they said it was, the newspaper said it was a balloon. He didn't have any firsthand knowledge, and he wouldn't give us any secondhand knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So we figure, well, that's that. Why waste any more time on him? So lo and behold, 10 years go by, and he shows up at one of our trips down to Roswell. We go down every July to take part as speakers at the UFO festival they have every July in honor of the Roswell crash. And with 1 year, he comes by, and he's an elderly gentleman now in his early 80s. And he says, well, I don't think I gave you the right information 10 years ago. As a matter of fact, I was in the big hangar where all the wreckage was brought, and I saw all the wreckage. Oh, well, that's interesting. That's a little different than what you told us before. And he said, I saw all this wreckage. It was strewn about the big hangar. And, I never saw anything that looked like an engine for that thing. Mm-hmm. There were no moving parts. In all of the wreckage, there were no moving parts.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, I want you fellas, meaning Don Schmidt, myself, he says, I want you fellas to promise me that before I die, you'll find out for me what made that thing fly. And so we said, well, sounds okay. Bill, if we find that out, we will certainly, you'll be the first one we call. Or at least the second. And so, lo and behold, we're thinking, oh, my goodness, how are we going to find that out? So far, we've been on this case over 20 years. We haven't found anything that resembles an engine. Well, I'm reading one of these metallurgical articles that I was telling you about that Anthony Bregaglia had sent me when they were trying to find something to match with titanium to replicate the memory properties of the memory metal. So I'm reading this one article, and let me tell you, it's hard going. It's just my eyes glaze over and my head starts hurting. And so I read this one paragraph, and I got a chill down my back. Now, every time we find something significant on this case, now even after 20 years, I still get a chill down my back when we find something new and significant. Well, I'm reading this article, and what it's stating is that they're testing this titanium nickel combination, and they said that the article stated that every time the test material was morphing, it was returning to its original shape, energy was created. There was an increase in energy. And that's when I got the chill down my back. I said, there's the engine.
The power source,
There's the power source. Somehow they were able to maximize and control the morphing to create energy to make that thing go. I don't know how they did it, but that's what they did. And there was more of this memory metal than any other type of wreckage. There was more of it than anything else. Mm-hmm. Whether they covered the ship in that or they covered the inside, we don't know. But they were able to harness the energy created and control it to make that thing fly. I don't know if they did it by controlling the shape of the universe. We don't know, but that I'm satisfied that that was the way that thing flew. Was it was able to control the energy created by the morphing metal, and so. Unfortunately, Bill Ennis had died maybe 3 months before we discovered that, and we were not able to get to him with what we believed to be the engine before he passed away.
Well, hopefully on the other side he got the answers to his questions. So we'll see.
We look skyward and said, "Bill, we found it." we hope he heard us.
Yeah. How big were these the craft that crashed? I mean, are there estimates of the size of it from?
Well, early on, there was a witness named Frank Kaufman who described a bat wing shaped affair, like a flying wing with a scallop. Rear of the wings that made it give it a bat shape. But Frank Kaufman turned out to be a hoaxer, a very good one, but we finally exposed him. And from the description of people who actually handled the material, it was a flying disc. It was circular, perhaps 30 feet in diameter. And inside was an egg-shaped affair, seamless, that was either the inner cabin or some sort of protective capsule inside that withstood the explosion that disintegrated the outer shell. And this inner cabin or escape pod or safety place in there was about 12 to 16 feet long. About 4 feet wide and about 6 feet high. It was an egg-shaped affair, described to us by people who saw it being transported back to the base. They went right through the town of Roswell, right down Main Street with this thing under a tarp. And the people who saw it described it as being egg-shaped. Walter Hout, who was the base public information officer who also was saw it in the hangar, described it as being egg-shaped. And it was, like I said, it would be about 12 to 15 feet long by maybe 4 to 6 feet in circumference.
Do we know, let's focus a little bit on the on the bodies, and we just have about 10, 15 minutes left. The bodies, the dead ones, and the one live one. I think it's interesting that the gray color might have been more a post-mortem color than anything that was mentioned in the book.
Yes, the one that was alive, and this is interesting. The best description. Well, it's actually was a one-word. Actually, a three-word description of it. A fireman by the name of Dan Dwyer was the pretty near the first one out there. When the call came into the fire station from one of the archaeologists, it goes into the fire station and the sheriff's department simultaneously. And he got out there. They thought it was like the crash of an aircraft. So he went out with the tanker, which is a pickup truck with a water tank in the back. So he gets out there first, and he's immediately drawn to the bodies. There's
right.
wreckage there, and you had that egg-shaped craft, but he's immediately drawn to the bodies. And he's walking towards the bodies, and something catches his eye, like out of the corner of his eye, and it's one of the aliens walking around. One had survived, and it was walking around the site, and
right.
he's stunned. And
I'll bet. It's a good thing he didn't have a heart attack right then.
right. He's stunned. And he's, oh my goodness, what do we have here?
What is this? Yeah.
And we get the rest of the story from his family, mostly his daughter Frankie Rowe, who was 12 years old at the time, and she's still alive. And she said, well, you know, we asked our father, what did it look like? And rather than giving a description, he just said, child of the earth. He said it looked like the child of the earth. Now, to a city slicker like me, I don't know what child of the earth is, but to the people in and around Roswell and the ranchers, the child of the earth goes by another name. Also, it's known as the Jerusalem cricket. Or a potato bug. It's like a little it's scorpion like, it's spider like, but it has a head that is quite unusual, and this is what gives it its name. If you look up child of the earth, put it in your browser, you'll on the internet and see what comes up, you'll know what I mean. But they call it the child of the earth because of these markings on the top of the head. When a child is born, its skull bones are not fused yet. You can still move them around, and you have sort of indentations where the seams are, and you see these lines. Well, the child of the earth, cricket, has these markings on the top of his head that reminds people of a child that is born with, you know, these bones unfused. There's markings on the top of the head. Its eyes are wide set, and it's amazing that if you can picture a gray, that's what the head looks like. It's oval shaped or it's pear shaped, but it has these markings on the head that remind people of the child of the earth. So he just said, child of the earth. Well, the next thing they said was, well, did you talk to it? And he said, yes, we talked to one another, but we didn't talk by moving our lips. We talked to one another in our heads, meaning something.
That's neat,
like,
isn't it? The universal language, telethought communication.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, then the next question was, well, what did you talk about? And he said, He says, I was concerned for it. You know, I was standing in wonderment, and before I could say anything, it talked to me in its head and said, don't worry about me. I and my comrades are there's nothing anybody can do. We accept our fate. My comrades are dead. I accept my fate. And don't worry about me. There's nothing that you can do. And that was basically it. So it was actually concerned about Dan Dwyer and his wonderment of what is this and what's going to happen here. And so that was pretty much it. Well, the complete description of what these things look like come from a fellow by the name of Len Stringfield, who was a UFO investigator in Cincinnati, Ohio, in the late 70s. He had a number of he collected stories about crashed UFOs, and of course he had a lot of friends at Dayton, Ohio, including some of the medical people who took part in the autopsies of the Roswell cadavers at Wright-Patterson. And right. The best descriptions come from Len Stringfield. He would get information, what he could, and they would make a sketch of what he thought they looked like, and he'd send it to one of his friends there in the medical department, and they would look at it and make suggestions. That this is not right. The head's too small, et cetera, et cetera. And he'd send it back, and then Len Stringfield would try another sketch. And finally, the final sketch that was approved by the medical person or persons that he knew at Wright-Patterson appears in our book, Inside the Real Area 51, and you've seen it, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's Len Stringfield's final sketch of what the medical people said the aliens look like. 3.5 to 4 feet tall, oversized pear-shaped head for its frame, four digits on the fingers and toes, little slit for a mouth, wide-set eyes, slightly slanted, not very much, and two holes where the nose would be, just two holes in the front of the face, and where the ears would be, two holes in the side of the head.
And they have nipples.
I'm sorry?
They have nipples.
They do?
Uh-huh. I'm looking at the picture now.
Okay. I don't... that's interesting.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it?
Yes, yes. Suggesting a humanoid type.
Yeah, appearance. Mammalian. Mammalian. Because,
mammalian, yes, yes.
I don't know. Do reptiles have nipples?
Do reptiles? No.
I don't think they do.
No,
they don't breastfeed.
Nourished,
yeah, they don't breastfeed, right. Yeah.
Yeah. They're nourished from an egg, so they don't have nipples.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the best description we have. And there's that alien autopsy video that they put out in the mid.
Yeah.
That is a total complete hoax. So if you have one, you can toss it because that is a complete
right.
hoax.
I had one, but somebody stole it from my clinic.
Well, that's called adding by subtraction. So
right.
You won't miss that at all.
Yeah.
But that's the best description. And as far as the coloration, the one that was alive was the pink. It was like pinkish gray, and then when they became deceased, the decay set in rapidly, and the colors changed from pinkish gray to purplish gray, greenish gray. Depending upon the lighting and the state of decay, the coloration descriptions vary.
Right.
But when it was alive, it was sort of pinkish gray from what we have been told by those who have seen it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty much it. We have a sketch. We have Len Stringfield's sketch in the book, which is pretty close to what everybody had described.
Right. Well, I really enjoyed the book, Inside the Real Area 51. It's a very, very complete investigation of Roswell as well as the role of Wright-Patt. It's really a labor of love with all the work that's gone into it.
22 years for me.
22 years, yeah.
And
yeah.
Don Schmidt, I think about 24. He started a few years before me, but like I said, one other thing is interesting is that in this recent trip to Roswell, I did go around town looking up interviews that I wanted to conduct, and one of them was the son of a fellow who died, missed him by 3 years. He was with the fire department on the base. This was not the city fire department, but the Roswell Army Airfield Fire Department. He was one of the firemen there, and the son told me that all his father ever told him was that the base fire truck, this would be the military fire truck, was turned around. They wouldn't let it on the site. So even their own people, they were turning back, not just the city fire department, but the base fire department as well. And he said that they had guns pointed at them to turn around. So what kind of, what kind of weather balloon was this?
Yeah, exactly. That's a good point. Well, would you like to give your contact information for our listeners?
Yes. You can go to our website at www.roswellinvestigator. That's www.roswellinvestigator.com. Or you can email me at tcarey, T-C-A-R-E-Y, followed by the numerals 1947. At AOL.com. You can get our book either at Barnes & Noble, that's inside the Real Area 51, at Barnes & Noble, or on Amazon, www.amazon.com. It comes in regular paper book that you can actually pick up and read. It comes in Kindle. It comes in audio book. However you want it, you can get it that way on Amazon. And Dr. Kolb, I would actually like to interview you at some point about your time at Wright-Patterson, if that would be possible.
Sure, that'd be fine. I'll tell you what I remember. It was a few years ago.
I am interested. I had no idea that you were at Wright-Patterson, and I would certainly like to interview you.
Sure.
About those officers that you talked to.
Right. Well, thank you very much for joining us today. I really appreciate the time.
My pleasure.
We've been interviewing Thomas Carey, inside the Real Area 51, the Secret History of Wright-Patterson. And next week, we'll be interviewing Dr. James Stein, The Paranormal Equation, A New Scientific Perspective on Remote Viewing, Clairvoyance, and Other Inexplicable Phenomena. And then on the 9th, Robbie Holt, Secret of Aboriginal Healing, A Physicist's Journey with a Remote Australian Tribe. Join us next week for Temple of Health Radio Show.